Welcome to the Advance Your Art podcast, where we talk about the journey from artist to entrepreneur and everything in between. You've worked hard to hone your craft. Now take it to the next level with tips, techniques, strategies, and routines used by successful artists to grow their businesses and careers. Now, let's get started and have some fun with your host, Yuri Cataldo.
Good afternoon, Salim. How are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well as well. Just keeping warm as the seasons change.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, exactly. Very important.
Exactly. So I'd like to start off with by just kind of asking a general question, and that is, how do you describe it is that you do?
So I have taken to answering this question by saying that I'm a weird hybrid. I am half musician and half arts advocate. Mm-hmm. And so it's truly a 50-50 blend for me. Today I started my day having a conversation about grant writing with some artists who live in Nepal.
Oh, wow.
Strangely. And then I spent 3 hours rehearsing a piece of music for amplified tables. Mm-hmm. And now we're having this conversation, and I'll go back to doing grant writing after we're done. So it's a very much a 50-50 mix. I am a musician. My primary instrument is the flute, and I have bachelor's, master's, and a doctorate in flute performance. Mm-hmm. And then in my doctoral studies, I started doing grant writing, and it really took for me. And so the other half of my life is spent as a grant writing consultant. And so I have a portfolio of clients, mostly arts, education, and social services, mm-hmm. ranging in budget size from $30,000 a year to $20 million plus a year. And so several major cultural institutions, and then some smaller organizations in that mix. So it's really a 50-50 blend. And I'm also a mom, so I have a little four-year-old. Mm-hmm. So that's certainly a commitment of time and resources and energy and love and everything as well. So yeah. That's what I do. I'm a hybrid. I'm a weird hybrid.
Well, you know, that's you say weird hybrid, but it feels like nowadays that everybody has to be kind of a hybrid of something.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Because I when people ask me kind of a similar thing, I often say that I have that bizarre, background of like arts and business that's not quite like I can't quite pick a job title for it, but
right.
It's a combination of a lot of different things because that's what's required these days.
Yes, definitely. And it seems like it's easier now to explain to people than it used to be. Mm-hmm. So that's good. People are beginning to see it as being more normal, yeah. I guess.
So I'm curious to hear a little more detail then about your journey. So what made you interested in studying the flute?
Well, that was an easy decision that was made by someone else. I was born in Mississippi, and my parents split up when I was like 7 years old. And so I was raised by my mother. We didn't have a lot of money, and she played the flute when she was in high school, and she still had it. Mm-hmm. So it was the instrument where we didn't have to buy one. I could just use hers, and it always came really easily to me. My family is musical. My dad was a band director. My grandmother was a piano teacher. And so there was always music around and always encouragement to study music. And so it was just a part of my day. And at least through middle school and high school, it was very natural for me. I didn't feel like I had to work very hard. I was kind of lazy. I didn't have to work hard, and it was easy to do well. So so that's where it came from. And then I just kept on through college.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. So it was kind of, I guess, a natural evolution to go right from undergrad right to grad school and then get your doctorate?
Well, I would say when I started, actually, you know, I say I continued to study music in college. There was a lot of doubt in college for me. And when I started college, in my undergraduate, I was not a music major. I studied music therapy.
Oh, okay.
And then I switched to English because I have always had an interest in writing and teaching. And then I quit school and I worked a desk job. And then I thought, wow, playing flute is really better than this desk job. And so I went back to school in my undergrad and finished in flute performance.
Okay.
So, and then did master's and doctorate in performance as well. But, it was something, it was something I didn't have to work very hard at and until I got to college. And then it was kind of like, oh, I have to practice and be better. And suddenly it wasn't as fun anymore, as it had been in high school, but it was always in, it was in those early days of my undergraduate, it was still something that I still enjoyed to a degree. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't sure if it was something I would do as a career at first. So okay. I kind of skipped around a bit in my undergrad.
Okay.
Which, you know, it took a lot of time, but I'm glad that I did it. I'm glad that I did different things and tried different things and took some time off, because it really helped me to understand what it was that I wanted to do. So,
Now, do you think, looking back now, that taking that time off and trying different things helped your career, or did it kind of slow things down ultimately?
I think, well, you know, I think I look back at myself in my 20s, and while my friends were spending their days locked away in practice rooms and working to take auditions and things like that, I just wasn't doing that as thoroughly or as well. And I think that there's a part of me that's disappointed that I never, you know, tried harder to be this great orchestral flutist or anything like that. But there's also a part of me that thinks that I wouldn't be who I am today if I didn't take that time, if I didn't try other things. Who knows what would have happened? You know, I might have been out and I might be living in a cave somewhere, like have driven myself crazy, you know. But
sure.
But I'm glad, you know, I'm glad, even though I think it helped my career in other ways, to know what I did and didn't want to do and how I could maybe explore other avenues. Mm-hmm.
While you were in school, what was your career path at that time? Like, were there already either places you want to go or, you know, or direct, I guess, end result type of things you were already going for while you were in school?
Yeah, once I committed to flute performance as a degree in my undergraduate, the ultimate goal at that point was to be a university, tenured university professor with the ability to go and perform on the side, either with an orchestra or as a chamber musician. So that was definitely the end goal. And when I was in my undergrad, this was in the early 2000s, you know, my teacher at that time was really encouraging me to do that, because she said, by the time you graduate, all the baby boomers will be retiring and there will be so many jobs. Just the landscape will just be full of jobs and you could just pick any job you want. And we all know that that's not reality. Not that she didn't know, she didn't see that, you know, she couldn't see an economic recession coming and baby boomers staying in their jobs and universities paring down on full-time tenured faculty in favor of adjunct faculty. And orchestras going out of business. And so, you know, there's a lot of kind of factors that came into play that made that certainly not the case. But But that was sort of the narrative through my undergrad, was that it's going to be so easy and you just follow this path. And when you get to the end of it, there's a job.
Mm-hmm.
And that was definitely not the reality. So,
mm-hmm. Sure. So what did you do then instead?
So, when I finished my bachelor's degree, I took a year off, of school and I taught. I kind of lucked into someone who had moved away and I got private students. And so I spent a year teaching, flute students, like middle school, high school flute students. And then I went to school for my master's degree in performance. Mm-hmm. When I finished that, I got to the other side and I thought, I don't know that I want to go on to my doctoral program immediately, but I don't know what but I do know that I have a lot of student loan debt and I need to do something. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't sure if I was going to jump into my doctorate. I actually almost went into a performance certificate program. It was just anything at that point to delay paying back student loans.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But I decided, no, I wasn't going to take on more debt through performer's certificate program. And I worked for 4 years, after my master's degree. I was an adjunct at a university at two colleges. And then I taught, probably a studio of 60 private students and then gigged as much as I could. And I did that for 4 years. And I would say that I got more out of that than I ever learned when I was in college in my bachelor's or master's degree. I think I learned more being out in the world and learning how I needed to market myself and how I needed to network with people and how I needed to manage my finances, mm-hmm. than anyone ever taught me in school. So it was eye-opening. It was a learning experience. And then I went on to the doctoral program, which now I look back and I kind of think, is a doctorate even something that students should think about pursuing? And I generally tend to recommend against not doing it unless you can get it paid for by someone else. But yeah, and then coming out of that program, and again, it was facing the same thing that I faced when I came out of my master's degree. Like, now I have a lot of student loan debt, and what am I going to do? Mm-hmm. You know, so just building something for myself that that was representative of my interests, but also realistic in terms of like, well, I have, in my last year of my doctorate, I had my child. And so, mm-hmm. I have to find something that's realistic financially as well. So, making it work, mm-hmm. while still wanting to do something that was, pleasing and wasn't painful to get up out of bed every day and think about doing. So.
Oh, sure. So I'm curious why, so I guess what made you decide to go back in to get your doctorate degree, especially now that you recommend that students don't go for a doctorate degree?
At that point, I started my doctorate in 2009. And at that point, I think that I was still on this mindset that it was something I had to do in my life.
Okay.
I think it had always been this end goal. Like, I have to get my doctorate. Mm-hmm. And, I had been teaching as an adjunct and I had thought, you know, if there's ever a role available where, it's a full-time role at a university, I do want to be as prepared as I can be for having a job like that, mm-hmm. or being considered for a job like that. And to be considered for a job like that, you do need a doctorate. But after my first year, you know, the reality of it hit that so many people were in school for a doctorate, and the job market out there just doesn't support it. Mm-hmm. There was there's a book by Angela Miles Beeching, I think is her name, called Beyond Talent. And the stats in that book are just really scary that, you know, if you look at higher education for doctoral students, there are maybe 300 doctoral students studying cello in the country, and maybe there are 6 job openings every year. Mm-hmm. And so just the realization of that set in after my first year, and I actually almost left. But we had moved across the country from Nashville to Oregon, mm-hmm. and to go into this program because I thought it was my destiny and I just needed to do it. And I decided I was going to follow through and finish it. And I did, but it was a hard realization that everyone was in this boat with you, and the job market just is not supporting the number of people who have the same goal as you do. So,
mm-hmm. so then after grad school, then, so you are in Oregon at this time, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So then in Oregon, what did you do then after you finished grad school?
So, after I finished, I finished while my daughter was young. So in her first year of life, I was finishing up my lecture document, which is the big piece that I had to do for my major. And then I had a secondary area of study, which was arts administration and nonprofit management. And I had a thesis for that. And so I was finishing that stuff during her first year and staying at home with her. And I started writing as a grant writer, as a volunteer for a couple of arts organizations that I really supported, and then was freelancing and teaching on the side to kind of help with income, mm-hmm. at that point. And we lived there for a year after my daughter was born, and then moved back to Nashville just because our families are all kind of around this area. So that's what I did in my first year, kind of out of being in classes full time and everything.
Okay. And so while you are still in getting your doctorate, what was it that got you interested in getting into grant writing and arts administration?
One of the things I really liked about Oregon as a degree program, in the music department, is that you were required to have a secondary area of study.
Oh, okay.
So you could add on pedagogy, or you could add on historical performance practice, or you could add on arts administration. And to me, that seemed like the most practical option. And I had already done a lot of teaching, and I thought, you know, pedagogy, I feel like I have a good handle on that. On the arts administration side, I had kind of dabbled in my master's degree. I had managed the orchestra in my grad program and managed the chamber music series. And so I knew I kind of had an affinity for it. I'm sort of like, I like to be a facilitator, like behind the scenes, kind of helping things happen. Mm-hmm. And so so I added on arts admin, and you could do an extra graduate certificate in nonprofit management. And so that was something that I really valued about that program, that you had to have this other component to your studies. And so through that, you take classes in fundraising, and you take a class in grant writing. So we only had one class, and I knew grant writing was for me because I'm an introvert, and it's sort of like the introverts fundraising. Fundraising for introverts is like grant writing. It's like you get to present yourself through the written word, which you can edit many times over, and you don't have to, you know, talk to people, which stresses me out. So that's how I got interested in doing it, and started doing it as a volunteer for some arts organizations who were led by really wonderful women, and we teamed up to work together, and I learned a lot from them through that. So I was really grateful for those opportunities. And then when we moved here to Nashville, I got a job working for our regional food bank. which covers like 46 counties. And they thought that, you know, as a volunteer, like that experience, even though it was a volunteer experience as a grant writer, was just as valid as any paid experience. So for people looking to like do grant writing or, you know, get into some kind of fundraising role or something with nonprofits, like just think about the volunteer work and those skills that you can gain from that. Because they really are just as valid as having, you know, a salaried position mm-hmm. with an organization.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. So I know that you also created the musical ensemble Chatterbird. How did that come about in your evolution in Nashville?
Yeah. Chatterbird. So when we lived in Oregon, I was involved with a lot of ensembles out there that were part of this movement called Alternative Classical. There was actually a big write-up in, I guess, the Wall Street Journal about Portland and their alternative classical scene. And I was involved with a lot of those groups as a performer and then as a grant writer and board member. And I really enjoyed the ethos of these ensembles, which is that classical music can be really relevant to people and be out in the community in ways that perhaps with symphony orchestras, it's not always. And so when we moved back to Nashville, I was really inspired by kind of a global movement called Classical Revolution. Mm-hmm. And there was a chapter in Portland that I was involved with. And Classical Revolution, you know, takes classical music out into the community, into bars and cafes and things like that. And it's really informal. It gives people who may not consider themselves to be professionals a chance to get up in front of people and make music. But it's also a chance to create dialogue within your community. And I really love the idea. There's not a classical revolution in Nashville. And I thought, I'll start a classical revolution. But then it became, well, I want to do this piece and this piece and this piece. And it became something where I knew that I was really wanting to curate something more intentional than just a classical revolution.
Okay.
And so that's where Chatterbird was born. And there wasn't before Chatterbird, and there's actually a kind of a sister ensemble, not a sister, but like an ensemble that started around the same time as us called Intersection. Before Chatterbird and Intersection came along, there wasn't really a whole lot of new music ensemble stuff being done in Nashville. And so since that point, there's just kind of been an explosion of really great contemporary classical music in town. And I think we just got here at the right time because Nashville's kind of started to become a little bit of a trendier town. So there are people contributing a lot to the arts and culture scene here. Mm-hmm. So that's where we came from. That was my inspiration.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I've spoken with actually a couple other people who are in Nashville right now on the parts of the art scene, and it seems like there's a lot going on a lot of different avenues in Nashville right now, which is great.
Yeah, it's really exploded in the last couple of years, which is great.
So with Chatterbird, is it a nonprofit? Is it a profit organization? How do you get, I guess, how does that work out then? So are you hired by organizations to come play, or what's the background with that?
Yeah, Chatterbird is a nonprofit. Our first concert was in 2014. And we are funded, let's see, from 2014 to 2015, we were mostly funded out of my pocket and the good graces of other musicians who were willing to kind of hop on board. Mm-hmm. But we, got our nonprofit status in 2015 and, since that point have become like a self-sustaining organization. So we have a mixture of grant funding, which is our dominant in the mix because that's what my experience is and my comfort level in fundraising. And then we're working to build on the individual side. We have some corporate sponsors, and then we do some fee for service performances, but we also have Some income that comes from, you know, ticket sales. We do about 3 concerts a year, and then we do small community performances and interactive art projects and things like that as they come along.
Mm-hmm. When you do your concerts, how do you find a venue?
That's a really great question. It's a really hard situation in Nashville because I wanted us to deliberately avoid academic and religious settings, which is where, you know, if you go to see chamber music, a lot of times there's a good reason, because those spaces usually have good acoustics. They usually have piano. They usually have seating. Mm-hmm. So when you go into non-traditional venues, you're having to bring a lot of that stuff in yourself, which is expensive. It's time consuming. It's a lot of effort and energy. And there's a big problem in Nashville. We're Music City, but we have a lot of, and we have a lot of venues, but they're primarily for commercial, like artists who are touring and things like that. And we either are treated like an event rental, so we have to rent the space and pay a fee, or we are treated like an artist that is booked through their traditional processes, which is, you know, not, we are not something that's going to make the same amount of money as we would if they booked like John Prine or some, you know, in some touring artist here. And so we have to find spaces where we can get a good deal on venue space. And we actually are in residence this year at a creative co-working space. There's a lot of creative co-working spaces around here that don't get a lot of use at night. And so we have a residency this year with a particular space. Mm-hmm. And we'll do all of our performances there, through the season. So
that's a really good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. So our first one is next week, for our season. So fingers crossed that everything goes really smoothly.
Excellent. Well, and I also know that in your bio, you talked about getting involved in improv and how that has affected your career and your playing. What made you first get interested in improv?
My teacher in my master's program is kind of a legendary experimental flutist. His name is Robert Dick, and he was very supportive of improvisation. And I think by the time that I studied with him, I had been in a phase where I felt a little boxed in musically. I felt very like there was one way to play the flute, and I was trying as hard as I could. Maybe I wasn't trying as hard as I could, but it felt very limited and closed. And I felt like I had lost a lot of the natural enjoyment that I had had for it, like in my high school days, when it felt like it came really easily. He encouraged me to try improvisation, but beyond just improvising on the flute, he talked me into taking, an improv comedy class. He talked about the benefits of improvisational, like acting, theater classes, and improv comedy. And so I took an improv comedy series of classes, and it really helped me to approach music making in a more creative way. Mm-hmm. It helped me to be more in the moment, less judgmental, critical of myself. It helped me to feel less insecure, and it helped me to think about music as being less of like a one-sided situation where I go and I play my thing and then I'm done, but it's more of a give and take with the audience and a conversation. And I think it really helped me to expand my boundaries creatively and think about what was possible with my sound, and with the characters and the dialogue that I can create through music. And it changed my worldview about music. And so I took these classes, and I studied a lot of the comedic improvisation books and theater improvisation books, and took some of those exercises. And with Robert, my teacher, we developed some workshops that that kind of apply those theater exercises to making music. And there was actually a book that was published around that same time by a man named Jeffrey Agrell, I believe, Theater Improv Exercises for Musicians or something. And it was like, wow, this guy is in my head. So, mm-hmm. so it was great. And yeah, it was the key that kind of unlocked, this new world for me. And I recommend to anyone that if you're looking to get out of a rut, to take an improv class. It doesn't even, I mean, it doesn't, so many of the principles of improvisation apply mm-hmm. to so many different parts of life. So, so yeah, it was a life changing thing for me.
Yeah. That sounds like it. That's great. I took an improv, well, part of an improv class in college, and it definitely throws you off your game on purpose.
Yeah.
So that's sometimes it's always nice just to be in a situation where you're like, I have no idea what I'm supposed to do or say. I guess I just go with it.
And yeah.
See what happens.
Yep. Exactly.
So yeah, it definitely helps to get out of your head. As busy as you are throughout the day, are there particular routines or rituals that you do now, or you know, specific types of websites or apps that you use to keep your life organized and to keep everything going?
I don't have any good routines or rituals. I don't think every day is different for me. And I think that that's, you know, I kind of appreciate that being my routine is mm-hmm. that, is that everything is different, but, life is crazy and there's a lot to remember. I do use some technology in my day to day to help me manage. None of it is going to alter anyone's life, I don't think, but I use Google, you know, Google Calendar to manage my schedule, and then I track all my hours in the day through this program called Toggle, T-O-G-G-L, mm-hmm. which helps, you know, freelancers to add up your hours, so at the end of the month when you're doing invoicing, you know how much time you spent and on what. I use Trello to help manage big projects. That's the only way I ever got out of school. My husband is a project manager, and so he helped me to get on board with Trello. And that kind of helps me visualize bigger steps in a project and break it down one by one and give things specific deadlines and action steps, et cetera.
I haven't tried using Trello yet. I have. You are, like, I think, the fifth or sixth person who has recommended it.
Yeah.
Now? I should probably check that out.
Yeah, well, there are lots of project management apps out there, like Trello, I guess, but Trello is just the one that I started with, and it worked for me, so mm-hmm. I like it. And then one big thing that I do use when I was really deep in the weeds on my doctoral writing is the Pomodoro technique.
Oh yeah.
You know, where so you have your little timer, your little tomato timer that you know will run for a 25-minute block, and then you take your 5-minute break. And I, for a long time there, I would organize my day in Pomodoros, and it's like I would do 4 on this specific project and then move on and do 4 on something else. And mm-hmm. just committing, like, the time, that 25-minute block, saying I am going to work on this one thing for the next 25 minutes, even if it's just me sitting here and thinking about it for 25 minutes, it was just like taking that first step on a run or brushing that one tooth. So you're brushing all your teeth. Like it starts me in a, thinking about something and creating a habit of getting something done, making some progress on something, mm-hmm. even if it's just me sitting there thinking about it, you know? So it was freeing to me in a way, just to say, I'm going to push start. And for the next 25 minutes, this is all I really need to think about. And you know, little by little, tomato by tomato, you know, I was making some movement forward.
Yeah.
So that one was huge for me, I think. And then I have some little apps on my phone that help with like breathing exercises and stress. When I was finishing up, one of the last things I did in my doctorate was kind of an independent study on mindfulness and meditation, and something that I really appreciated, another thing about Oregon that I really appreciated was that faculty had experience there in that, and there were lots of meditation classes and yoga classes and things like that offered for students. And so I tried to take advantage of those things whenever I could. And breathing exercises really help because I do a lot of things, but I'm constantly worried that I'm forgetting to do something, or, you know, stressed out, and it creates some stress and anxiety. And so just finding some ways to be centered, I think, is really meaningful for me. So,
yeah, I'm surprised that they don't teach students more like in-depth meditation and relaxation techniques, because it is so beneficial and helpful when you're going through huge amounts of stress.
Yeah, definitely.
What so which meditation techniques worked best for you? Like, whether is there a specific, like, are you into TM, or was it just sitting there and breathing? Like, what's helps you the most?
Breathing exercises, I think, are the best thing for me.
Okay.
And I got into doing Kundalini yoga in my doctoral degree, and there's something about the repetitiveness of the motion and chanting paired with chanting, mm-hmm. That was really powerful for me. The idea of mantra is something that really, I think, has a positive effect. And I mean, it's not necessarily me lighting incense every morning and like sitting down, but I mean, really like using the power of mantra, or, you know, that powerful repetitive thought process that can bring me to a better place every day. So that's something that's really useful for me.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So with everything that you've done, I mean, clearly there have been times where you kind of jumped into things and felt nervous about what was going to happen next or where it was going to go. How, when you approach projects or even what you're going to do next, how do you look at fear and what to do with it and overcome it?
I think that if I'm a little fearful about a project or anxious, that's a good thing. it kind of shows me that I'm challenging myself to get out of my comfort zone. My husband would probably say that I probably strive too much to be in a place of of being fearful, because I am always trying to kind of push myself to do more or to do something a little uncomfortable. I think it's a good place to be, because it means that you're pushing yourself and you're learning about yourself and you're setting new boundaries and trying a new direction. And so when I'm in those situations, I take a minute to say, this is good. I mean, this is not a bad situation to be in. I try to be as prepared as I can, which I think helps to mitigate some of the anxiety that goes along with it. And then I just try to make more opportunities like that in life. So I think the best thing for me is to embrace it and work really hard to be good at whatever it is I'm fearful of, you know,
mm-hmm.
and do something else.
Yeah, sure. No, that's great. Sometimes you just need to, you know, keep going along and press along.
Yes.
What would you say is the best advice you've ever received?
I think that probably the best advice that I've gotten is that for me, I shouldn't stop expecting that the way I want my life to be, or the terms that I want to live, the terms in which I want to live my life, aren't possible. I want to make music. I think a lot of my grant writing work is driven not just by a desire to have financial stability, but also I really enjoy helping other people, helping to facilitate projects to happen, helping to create new art, helping to feed people, mm-hmm. Helping to support education for, you know, various constituencies. And so I have things that I think both the music side and the fundraising side for me are driven by like very deep passions. And I think that, you know, there's kind of an expectation that you need to do one or the other, but mm-hmm. I think the best advice for me that is from my husband really is just that don't stop expecting that you can't make a life that works for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's wonderful advice. And that's a very positive way to look at things as well. If you were speaking with somebody who wanted to follow in your footsteps, or nowadays, you know, a student who's studying the flute and they're kind of curious about where to go, next in their career because of the way that the world is working now, and as you mentioned before, the very few jobs that are out there available, what advice would you give them?
I think that if I were looking back at myself when I was in my 20s, I would tell myself to be okay with taking time to really figure it out and explore everything that I'm passionate about. Not to beat myself up a lot for changing my mind, switching a little bit, because I mean, those experiences and those trying things out like that helped me to know who I was and what I wanted. And you know, for someone who, a musician looking at making a career, I think you should try to look at all the things that you're passionate about in your life and figure out different ways in which you can make a little piece of a living here and a little piece of a living here, and you get to be the in control of your own destiny in that way. And don't be afraid to explore those little pieces or those little passions that you might have, because something down the road could come along, an opportunity could come along, or you could make your opportunity to make that work for you financially and support you, and support other parts of, you know, your music making, and building. So.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Yeah, that's great. So, again, thank you so much for chatting with me this afternoon. If the listeners would like to hear more about you or get in contact with you, what's the best way they can do that?
My website, probably, I think, is the best way. Celine, Celine Thaxton, Thaxton.com. And it's got a link to Chamber Music, Chatterbird, Chamber Music stuff. There's email address and everything, so they can find me there.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I will put a link in the show notes so they can click directly right into there.
Awesome.
Cool. Great. Well, thank you so much. This has been fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank Great. You. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to the Advancer Art Podcast. If you truly enjoy this, please head over to iTunes and download additional interviews, as well as hit the subscribe button so that as new episodes come out, they will automatically go to your phone. Also, while you're there, please give us a 5-star rating, which helps our iTunes rankings. If you'd like to see more information, head on over to advanceyourart.com, where you can find information about each of the guests, as well as projects that I am working on. And always, if you're in the Boston area, please feel free to reach out. I can be found on Twitter at YCataldo, or you can email me, Yuri@advanceyourart.com. Thank you so much and have a great day.